Hello, and welcome to Breast Cancer Conversations, a podcast brought to you by survivingbreastcancer.org. I'm Laura Carfing, breast cancer survivor and founder of survivingbreastcancer.org, a nonprofit organization providing community, education, and resources to empower those diagnosed with breast cancer and their caregivers from day one and beyond. Hello, hello, my friends, and welcome to another episode of Breast Cancer Conversations. I am so glad you tune in week after week where we drop the latest and greatest topics that you guys are asking for. We go out, we meet with doctors, we meet with the patients, we meet with people in our communities to share the stories and provide you with information that will hopefully inspire and empower. Today, we have such a great topic that has been highly requested because when you're diagnosed with a metastatic disease, you know, we're like, oh gosh, how much time do I have? Am I going to die? When am I going to die? And how do I tell my kids? How do I tell my husband? How do I manage relationships? And also, how do I navigate work? Do I immediately quit work? Do I go on disability? Do I continue to work? Do I have to continue to work to be able to maintain my health insurance and benefits? All of these questions are swirling in our heads. And today, I am so excited that Abigail Johnston is leading our MBC webinar series and brought together an amazing panel of women living with metastatic disease to answer some of these questions about what it is like to have MBC and continue in the workforce. Before we get started, I do want to share that we just got back from the LBBC, that is the Living Beyond Breast Cancer Metastatic Conference down in Philly. It was so amazing. It was 3 days of educational content, connecting with others living with metastatic disease. And we at SBC, that's survivingbreastcancer.org, aka SBC, we got to exhibit and let people know about all of our free programs and resources, including our Thursday Night Thrivers Meetup. This is our support group for all stages of breast cancer, all subtypes of breast cancer. There are specific subgroups that we have for those living with metastatic disease, as well as inflammatory breast cancer. We are working on developing a support group for those living with lobular breast cancer. And I can't keep secrets. I want to host something also for the caregivers out there. So stay tuned. So much more to come. But you can check out all of our events and programs at survivingbreastcancer.org/events. And just as a reminder, if you're not already on our mailing list, please subscribe to our mailing list. We send out newsletters every Monday. It's a wealth of information. I promise nothing is spammy. We have our podcast, our weekly events. We have blogs, stories, education, the latest and greatest what's happening in the breast cancer arena. So you can, again, go over to survivingbreastcancer.org and subscribe to our mailing list. All right. Well, without further ado, welcome to the conversation.
My name is Holly. I'm in the Pacific Northwest. I'm in Portland. I was diagnosed de novo metastatic mixed type in January of 2022. No history, no problems. Just came up with bone mets and two kinds of cancer. I just hit the serious jackpot. I'm on my first line of treatment. I'm on letrozole, Ibrance, and I had to switch from Zometa to Xgeva due to some complications with Zometa. So don't let people tell you that Zometa is no big deal because I had to have my out. So it was bad. So anyway, and I work at the Humane Society here in Portland. I have a very physical job. I do all of the buying for the shelter, facilities, animal care, and our store. And I move all the stock as well. So yeah, it's a very physical job. If I had all the money in the world, I wouldn't be working. So that's where I'm at.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lisa Hahn. I live in Alexandria, Virginia, which is right outside DC. And I was diagnosed also de novo in 2019, in the fall of 2019. And I work for a large nonprofit called Pew Charitable Trust. You may have known us because we support NPR and also the Pew Research Center. So if you read articles, oftentimes there's, according to the Pew Research Center, that's our sister organization. And I have been at Pew for 5 years and was diagnosed 4 years ago with metastatic breast cancer.
I'm Dawn McDaniel, and I have a PhD in psychology with an emphasis in consciousness, spirituality, and integrative health. And I started Mystical Energies so that I can offer courses on transformational healing from within, leveraging all of the work that I did and my research into something that would be helpful for others. I started that in October of 21, hit my 2-year anniversary, and was diagnosed with breast cancer a second time with calcifications in November of 2021. So my challenge with starting my business and going through the whole process of having stage 1B breast cancer and through the surgeries and through all of the treatments and then getting the all clear at the beginning of March and then being diagnosed with metastatic cancer because I actually thought I had an appendicitis. And I went in and they phone met and metastasized to my liver as well. So I just got that diagnosis in April of 2023. And so I'm still navigating those waters of what is this going to look like going forward.
I'm Wendy Casper, and I'm also a psychologist. But my PhD is in industrial organizational psychology, and I'm a professor and an associate dean at a school called University of Texas at Arlington. We're outside of Dallas. I've been working there for a while, and I've been doing research on work-life balance since the 1990s when I was a grad student. And in 2018, I got diagnosed with stage 1B or 2, depending on which staging you use, triple positive breast cancer. I worked throughout my treatment through chemo, through radiation, through my targeted therapy, and I'm continuing to have treatment with Arimidex for 10 years. And so I became really interested in this idea of how to combine work with your cancer treatment. And I started studying that a couple years ago. And so I started off by doing interviews. And at this point, I've interviewed more than 50 people who were diagnosed with cancer while they were working and have learned a lot about all the different journeys that they've taken. And my real interest has been to learn what I can, but then turn that into something I might do to help. And so I started talking just to breast cancer patients. I initially talked to women with early stage, then started talking to metastatic patients. I've now spoken with men and people with other types of cancer as well. And one of the things I've learned is that there's a real need for more information about how to communicate at work about the diagnosis. Issues like disclosure and how and when you disclose and how you kind of frame that, what you say about it. And so right now, I'm working with two colleagues, one in public health and one who is in communications. And we're actually collecting pilot data on an intervention where we give some guidance. It's an e-learning module on how people can communicate at work.
One thing that happens so that's been really when exciting you that are diagnosed with a serious illness is you have to decide who to tell and how to tell people. So Wendy, you talked about that a little bit about disclosure. So when do you tell someone? How do you tell someone? Very important things to wrestle with. And it's not a one size fits all situation. I'm sure you guys will agree with that, that every employer is a little bit different. Every employee is a little bit different. Depends a lot on the type of work that you do, how your employer might make reasonable accommodations. So I want to make sure that you get that buzzword in your head, reasonable accommodations. What does that mean? Who the heck knows what that means? But it means something in the context of what you do and how your job is done, right? Holly probably can't work from home. Probably can't stock those shelves working from home. So that would not be a reasonable accommodation within the context of what she's doing. And I just give you a kind of a silly example so that you can see it very clearly, because this can be a very difficult conversation. So, but important to remember that term, reasonable accommodations. Why is that important? every employer is required under the Americans with Disabilities Act to provide reasonable accommodations for people to work. It's really that simple. It can be more complicated in practice. But for those of us who are diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, we are covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act. That is a legally recognized disability. And while those words may be terrible to hear, at the same time, that act, the ADA, does apply to us and can provide some protection. So that's one thing I want to make sure to throw out there. Some of you may be familiar with FMLA. That's only applicable to certain organizations. It's not applicable to everybody. You don't always get paid, but that is also another protection if you need to take time off of work, you need to have medical treatments, those kinds of things. So just wanted to throw out some of those terms because that becomes really relevant when we start thinking about we need to continue to work. But how do we do that? And so that's why I wanted these ladies to be here tonight to tell you how they have done that. So there's a couple of websites that I wanted to make sure to draw attention to. And Brenda may put those up on the screen. Thank you, Brenda. One is cancerandcareers.org. This is a reliable organization that provides lots of resources in terms of how you navigate these things, navigate conversations, navigate, you know, what types of laws might protect you, those kinds of things. So very important. Another resource that I wanted to highlight up front is Triage Cancer. Triage Cancer has a lot of resources, lots of state-specific resources, as well as federal resources. Highly recommend them. The founders of Triage Cancer literally wrote the book on cancer and the law. So they might know a few things about that stuff. But also, they've done a really great job of just pulling together lots of resources from other organizations, as well as creating their own resources. So if you are living with MBC and working, cancerandcareers.org and triagecancer.org are two resources I would encourage you to bookmark and perhaps refer back to because that can orient you to the conversations, give you some ideas of options, that sort of thing, so you don't feel like you're kind of out on a limb, which sometimes we probably all feel in this MBC experience. With that, I wanted to turn it over to Lisa to share a little bit about how she disclosed her diagnosis, maybe how that went, and how things are going.
So you'll be interested to know that I've not really disclosed my diagnosis. When I started all of this, I initially found a lump in my breast and, you know, was going through the test and biopsy and all of this. And so I decided I wasn't going to say anything until I knew what I had and what the plan was. So at that point, I was looking like I was stage two-ish. We weren't really sure yet. And I was going to do chemo and then I was going to do surgery and then radiation. And that was the plan. So of course, at that point I went to my boss and I said, you know, this is what we're looking at. This is the plan. And I had planned on working as much as possible. So I worked with HR and went on FMLA, as Abigail mentioned, and they talked to me about intermittent disability, which I had never heard before because I was really worried. I didn't know which part would knock me out the most. And, you know, maybe I could work, you know, maybe during radiation, maybe I could work for a few hours during the day or whatever. So I was sort of thinking, how could I manage, you know, how much time I get off and how could I make this all work without knowing? So, so that was the plan and, you know, sort of shared that with everyone. And then literally the day I started chemo, we found out I was actually stage four and that the cancer had spread to the bones. And so we quickly had to shift, or not that quickly, but my oncologist said, what we're going to do is we're going to finish these four rounds of chemo, and then you'll start a CDK4/6 inhibitor and, you know, an AI. So at that point I was like, okay. So we went through the four rounds, and then I think I was still trying to digest all of this. So I just went back to work and said that they had changed my treatment based on how I had reacted to the first four rounds of chemo. And I thought and at that point, I also didn't know. I kept thinking, you know, it was going to be worse and that I wouldn't be able to work. And slowly everything was looking okay. You know, the scans were coming back okay. And so I just was like, well, all right, I'll just keep working and keep this until something happens. So I was still working from home and going in maybe a day or two. And then, so that was like January, February, March-ish. And this is March 2020. So at this point, COVID hits and everyone goes home and starts working remotely. So honestly, I think because of that, I didn't really have to disclose much more because we're all working from home. It was much easier on me. And I was able to just work. And, you know, if I got tired, I could just at lunchtime take a nap or take a break if I needed to. So it really benefited me. During that time, that first year is a little rocky, trying to make sure you have the right treatment and things like that. You're adjusting to treatment. I had to do 5 rounds of chemo on my back, but I was able to schedule those at 8 o'clock in the morning. They took 5 minutes and I was back at work by 9. Again, no one really knew. I did fine with treatment. And so, you know, my boss knew. I told her, I was like, look, just so you know, I'm doing radiation in the morning. You know, I'll let you know if anything happens. And she's, you know, she was like, absolutely. If you need to take time off, you're fine. But I was actually fine. It was just 5 rounds. So I was okay. So I kind of fit everything in and I just kept going because I didn't know any different. And I just thought, okay, I'm going to keep going. One thing I did do during this time is I kept my intermittent disability because I kept thinking if something changes and I need to take more time off, I'm very lucky. My organization is quite large. So we do have a lot of great policies. And I had been at Pew for exactly 1 year when this all hit. I mean, everything kind of lined up. I had been at Pew 1 year, so I was eligible for everything. I was eligible for all the disability leave. I was eligible for my 401k vesting, you know, all of that good stuff. So I had this great safety net behind me. So I've kept my intermittent disability with the thought that if something happens and I have to change, you know, I need more doctor's appointments or something, I have that buffer that protects me. I haven't really had to use it very much. There's been 1 or 2 years where I've had quite a few doctor's appointments where I've had to use that. Recently I did have, and I've been stable this whole time too. So that's the other thing that I think has been, something to consider is that all my scans have continued to be stable. I'm still in the same treatment. I'm still on, Verzenio and exemestane, which I have been on since that January of 2020. So this is like my third full year, almost on 4 years, which I know is unheard of. And that's a whole other topic, but Verzenio and being able to handle that. But earlier this year, I was getting more and more stomach issues and I was feeling nauseous and things like that. And so I talked to my doctor and she said, let's take a break from the Verzenio and, you know, take like a 3-week break and then we'll put you back on it. And she said, but when you go back on it, chances are you're going to have all the side effects you had at the very beginning, or you might have more. So I thought, you know what, at that point, I am going to take some time off. So I applied for short-term disability. I took about a month off just to really make sure my body was okay. And I had time to go off and go back on it. I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to have any worse side effects than I've ever had or anything like that. So I was able to go through short-term disability at that time and then, you know, return to work and everything's been fine. With COVID, my organization first started when we started going back to the office. They were very flexible. I think everyone, you know, the offices were very flexible in the beginning. They would say, at first it was just come in when you need to. And then it was, you have to come in 40% of your time. But they looked at the full month and they said that could be anything that you want. It could be a couple of days this week, a couple of days that week. My boss was very flexible at this. She knows my immune system is compromised. So she understood where I was coming from. So she was fine. And, you know, she worked with me and I'm still getting all my work done. You know, I'm still logging on every day. So not an issue there. This past summer, Pew decided that they wanted everyone back in the office Tuesdays and Wednesdays every week. And I knew that that was not going to, I would not be able to handle that. I mean, I'm fine during the week working from home. Generally on the weekends, I'm pretty, you know, I'm tired. And I knew that if I had to go in Tuesdays and Wednesdays, that would deplete my energy. And there's no way I would be able to, you know, have any energy left on the weekends to spend with my time, my family, or do the things that I really want to do. So that's when I did look into ADA and getting an accommodation. And so I worked with my oncologist and we worked on the form and submitted that. And I did get an accommodation, so I don't have to go in. But I did tell my boss, if you need me, you know, if there are special meetings, I, of course, will go in, or, you know, things that are happening, I'll go in. I just can't go in 2 days a week, every single week. It's just, you know, it's just absolutely exhausting. One thing about disclosure and filling out forms, my oncologist is great. She works with me about how we want to word things on my form. And so I am probably overcautious about how I word things on forms. But, you know, sometimes they would write things on forms and they would go into my whole diagnosis and what was going on. And I was like, no, we don't need all that. You know, we just need to say side effects from cancer treatment. Like, I don't, you know, we do not need to disclose all of this information. So they've been great with working with me and submitting those forms. You know, every year we submit my intermittent disability form. So I keep that. Like I mentioned, I keep that going on, and I'm going to check my notes real quick. Another thing on disclosure that's interesting is, you know, I've been working with MBC for 4 years now. So at this point, some of my coworkers know that I, you know, have breast cancer and have a compromised immunity, but there's also new employees now. And so I just haven't told them. A friend of mine, she's been working with MBC for 7 years now. And she said that, you know, because of turnover or whatever, she said, actually now only one or two people know anymore. She said, because they don't really tell the new people, you know, I mean, there gets to the point where it just doesn't make sense. And, you know, it's more of a need to know, I think, like, does this person need to know what's going on and what do they need to know? And so so that's sort of been my strategy.
Thank you, Lisa. And I love how you brought up a couple of things really that well. I didn't talk about, which is there is a form process to apply for reasonable accommodations. Getting your doctor on board is super, super important. And let me just say that making sure that your doctor is aware of all of your side effects is something that's very important, so that if anybody ever has to get your records or verify that it's been documented in your medical record. But to Lisa's point, they don't need to know everything. So those were great, great input there. Thank you, Lisa. And I'm so happy that there are those organizations that will work with people. That isn't always the case. So I'm glad that you've had a pretty good experience with that, Lisa. So Wendy, I wanted to come back to you. I know you talked a little bit about your research and the things that you're interested in, but are you able to share with us some of what you've seen so far, maybe trends that you've seen?
I have talked with a lot of people, not all of them with metastatic disease, but a decent chunk of them with it. And I see that there is tremendous variability in how people get treated at work when they have a cancer diagnosis. Fortunately, it's been more common for me to talk to people who have been treated pretty well and have said that their employers have been supportive and kind, but I have talked to a handful of people who had really difficult times. The couple people that had the hardest time were all relatively new in their organization. And so I think that having some tenure, I was fortunate when I had my diagnosis that I had like 15 years of tenure, but even people that have had, you know, a couple years, they seem to get treated better. But I did talk to a couple people who got diagnosed when they were like in a brand new job for a month or two, and they did not have a good experience. there's two of them I can think about, and very different cases. One of the women, you know, three different times that she had to go out on leave, and she really had to fight and eventually went on medical disability. But she had lots and lots of trouble getting accommodation, actually from the Postal Service, which surprised me. As a government employer, I would have thought that she would have had an easier time, but she didn't. The other woman who was new in her organization and had a very difficult time with her boss and getting accommodation and support has since left and gone to an employer that is much more supportive. Fortunately, that has happened. So there have been some experiences like that. Most of the people, and I mean, everybody has a different perspective on disclosure. And I've talked to people who didn't tell anybody, fewer of those, because probably the people that volunteer to be interviewed by me are probably more comfortable talking about it. I've talked to people who write on social media about it and everything in between. You know, and it's probably most typical for people to do kind of a need to know kind of thing. But I have talked with a variety of people who disclose more broadly, and we're very comfortable with that. And most of them did okay in terms of managing things at the workplace. But of course, each person's going to be unique and have their unique relationship. So I can say that the biggest trend is that there's a lot of differences, and that, but fortunately, more of the people I've talked to have been treated better rather than worse and had, you know, reasonably good experiences with the workplace. Not commonly. The woman who eventually went on disability that was working for the Postal Service, I did talk to her about it, and she actually had talked to some legal counsel, and that was kind of how she wound up getting disability from the Postal Service, even though she was employed there for a brief period of time. Most of the other people haven't expressed that they've actually done that. But most of the people have had relatively good experiences. And so if you have a good experience, there's no reason to go off and talk to an attorney. That's really more for a person who isn't getting the support they need, who might need to. But the woman who, not the one at the Postal Service, but the other woman who was treated really poorly by her supervisor, she was very self-confident and very aware of her rights and very informed about the Americans with Disabilities Act. And she was very comfortable. She went right to the vice president of HR, and she really advocated for herself. And once she did that, her boss really backed off because he was really out of line. And so, but she was fortunate to be knowledgeable and feel comfortable going to the VP of HR.
So I wanted to turn to Dawn next, just because your situation a little different from Lisa and Holly, in that you're building a business of your own. And it's not like you have a supervisor to disclose things to. So how does living with MBC and working, how is that playing itself out in your business, Dawn?
The biggest thing was trying to get my head wrapped around the diagnosis. And as I mentioned, I started my business, and then a month later, I was diagnosed with breast cancer at the start. As I'm sure you all have experienced, it's not just one thing that happens, it's multiple things. So my husband was laid off that same year. And so that same week. And he decided he was going to start a business. So the two of us are starting businesses. So I go back and forth between helping him, because sometimes it's easier to not have to think through all of the pieces and just do some work, just pay some bills or do that kind of thing for him. So I'm going through that type of ups and downs with just trying to figure out, and then also with my health and my chemo. I'm on in HER2 every 21 days, and then Zometa every 12 weeks, and that completely wipes me out for a long period of time. I think last time it was almost 3 weeks that I had it. So just trying to navigate that time and energy. And then because I don't have a supervisor and I don't have anybody that I'm accountable to, it can be even more challenging. And I can say, oh, I'm just not feeling up to it. And then 2 weeks have passed and I haven't been able to finish projects that I wanted to. In talking about disclosure, while I don't have someone to disclose to as a boss, I have grappled with how do I tell or how much do I share with clients? Because I'm worried about taking on too many clients and not having the energy to commit to them. And at the same time, I need to have the income so that I have the flexibility so that I can do the things that I really want to do, like spend time with my kids before this disease inevitably progresses. So trying to figure out that disclosure space. And in some instances, because I do energy healing and workshops and courses and that type of thing for personal development, that's a more compassionate consumer base. So my clients are much more compassionate. And in that sense, that vulnerability can also be an asset. So I'm just trying to balance between that and making sure that people don't think, oh, she's too sick for me, or and then just looking foolish, basically. This is my biggest fear, is that I just look foolish. So that's kind of been my struggle, my ups and downs. And but things are really, I'm kind of hitting a stride with the Enhertu, and my symptoms are not terrible other than the Zometa. And so I feel like I'm starting to get to a point where even if I felt really bad, I could push through for a few hours. Like Lisa was saying, I could do a little bit.
Would you be able to share a situation where a client responded very well to your disclosures?
I had one client that when I shared my situation actually ended up sharing her own journey with breast cancer years before. And while it's not the same, she felt a stronger connection by me sharing that and being vulnerable and open to that. I actually haven't had anybody that's been turned off by that. So that's been good. I also try to, I can select who I want to work with. So there's that benefit as well. And if it doesn't seem like it's a good fit in our introductory call, then I won't take them on. But yeah, sharing that, I can't remember what the term is, but relationships are built on shared experience. And so that shared experience can really open up doors. And that's not just with clients, that's with people at SBA that I'm talking with that are trying to help me get different things. Those are different mentors that are able to help me kind of navigate. And again, I'm discretionary about how what I share and how much I share and who I share it with. So from my perspective, I would say just pay very close attention to that intuition and understand that it's okay to not say stuff. And
thank you for sharing that, Dawn. I remember how people reacted differently to me when I was pregnant. You know, clients not hiring me because they were anticipating that I was going to be out on maternity leave and that sort of thing. So you never know what's going to be important to a client. And so I love that you brought up intuition, because so many times these things are not objective. It's how you feel in the moment with that particular person. So thank you, Dawn, for sharing that. All right, Holly, we are over to you. You have the most physical job of everybody, so.
I, in general, am a very open book. I don't like to hold back to the detriment sometimes of myself. But it was because I was in the middle of the diagnosis. So I had to keep telling my boss, oh, I might have to, you know, take X amount of weeks off for radiation, X amount of off for chemo, blah, blah, blah. I'm getting perky 60-year-old boobs and I'm really excited about that. But none of that happened because I was de novo within a very short amount of time. So I was very open with my boss at the time. And I work for a nonprofit. So again, like Lisa, when you're working for a nonprofit, I think they're a tad bit more walking their talk. I say that tad because I don't necessarily think it's true sometimes, because their job is to keep the company from being sued, right? Like, so, and I'd say for me, as the years have gone on, HR has changed. And so I was talking to a person in people and culture, and she had no idea about my diagnosis. No clue. Like, she literally burst out in tears when I told her. And so again, you kind of don't realize for you, this is normal. And then for everything that you think you're done with, you're really not. You sometimes have to revisit it. My boss, my direct supervisor, her dad just passed away from some weird, unusual cancer. He was an Eastern European, like, steadfast guy, and he just in 4 months was gone. So she's very, very receptive to me because of what she went through with her dad. So I'm not saying that any boss wouldn't be receptive, but she's incredibly receptive because of it. And I feel like she understands when I say, I just can't come in today. I'm going to work from home. I'm going to answer. Basically, I just answer emails. I mean, because that's all I can really do from home. So they've been very accommodating with that. I did not use FMLA for the first year. I was in such, like, not denial, but just one foot in front of the other. I didn't use any FMLA for the first year. And it wasn't until I talked to this new people and culture person that she's like, you have to do that FMLA every year. And I was like, oh, I didn't know, because I hadn't used it. So I went ahead and did the paperwork for that and followed through with that. And yet, like, you know, I come and go pretty well. And I'm lucky in that way. I've been here 10 years. So part of it might be that I've been here a long time. And so I'm lucky enough to have a super flexible job that no one really counts on me, except for the times that I can, you know, arrange for them to count on me, basically. So, yeah. So for me, work, it can be hard to be like, oh yeah, well, my diagnosis, blah, blah, blah. And somebody just looks at you like, what are you talking about? And then you have to go into it. So it is an interesting sort of dichotomy of, I'm doing my job, I'm working, I'm showing up every day, but I want some accommodation for that. And so, yeah, I'd say that for me, that's been probably one of the most difficult things, is just taking advantage of what's available to me and not missing out, because my family is what's most important, not work.
Is there an interaction, you know, that sticks out in your mind that was either really good or went really badly that you would be able to share?
You know, I would say the people and culture thing, where I was talking to this person who I thought knew about my diagnosis, and it seemed really flip for me to just say, oh, well, blah, blah, blah. And then her being in tears, I was like, I don't know how to deal with this. Like, you're not supposed to be crying. You're supposed to be helping me, not the other way around. But she's a very strong woman, and she's really empathetic. And she, it just hit her in the feels, right? So I'd say that was pretty shocking. And as we all go
as
through
a,
this,
a
and
great
live
reminder,
this very weird
the things
life,
that we've normalized
we
within our community, that then we
everybody.
Say that to somebody outside the community, and yes, sometimes that can be a little shocking. But when you're in that situation where it's almost like you're the one who has the diagnosis, but this person is so upset and you're almost having to care for them and how they are reacting. How did that hit you? How did that resonate with you?
Well, at first I was really shocked because, like I said, I would have thought she would have read my file and known, you know, but I don't know that that's, like I said, I don't know if they're that, like if that's that obvious in my file. So, I would say basically that I became the caregiver, but I tried really hard to step back and be like, it's okay. I'm okay. I'm all right right now. I'm good. You know? So I did try and reinforce that, I was coming to her for help. And I'm sorry, it seemed really blunt of me. I would never have approached it that way had I known that she didn't know. And so then it was more like damage control, really. And then everything was okay. And we went on about our business and we've had great relationships since then. But yeah, I think going to work every day and what is normal for us is not
I hear
normal
you.
For
I've
people.
Experienced
people
the same thing. It's
amazed.
That's always
wait,
a weird,
what?
Like, how do you navigate that?
Wait, what?
You know, Lisa, like, did you have any stories, whether good or bad, as far as interactions or anything that you want else you want to share?
You know, I worry about like, what are people going to ask me or whatever, but you know, you have to remember that in a professional environment, people are going to be professional, not ask you too much. So I sometimes use that to my advantage of what I tell people because they do realize there is that professionalism or, you know, not asking sensitive information or too personal information, things like that. So people are generally very good about what they ask and how they ask things.
I personally, now that I look back, wish I would have taken time off. Once my initial diagnosis happened, I wish I would have had the forethought to just be like, I'm heading to the beach and I'm going to be gone for a while. And I'll come back when I'm ready. Like, I wish I'd had the forethought to do that. For me, I don't think it, obviously it didn't make any difference. But for me, I think having the ability to get your thoughts together and not have day-to-day stuff to worry about would have been really helpful for me.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, Holly. I think that you're trying to deal with so much. And that's one reason why I also took some time off in April, as I was mentioning, is I never took any time off. You know, I was in this like, oh my gosh, I have to keep working. I have to keep going. I don't know what's going to happen. And I didn't take that time for myself. And I think it's really important. And, you know, as I mentioned, like I was in such shock, I couldn't tell people. And I think maybe if I had like digested it better and I felt more comfortable, I think I would have been able to talk about it better because the other reason I couldn't tell anybody because I kept crying. I didn't know that that was a normal response, right? Like in the beginning, you're just all teary. So yeah, definitely. I think that's important is taking that time to just sit with things and become comfortable with them as much as you can.
Yeah, I was going to say that I approached things very pragmatically, and I'm still in that trying to figure out what it all means and what treatments and language and words and different medicines. And so I'm kind of all in that space, but I approached things very pragmatically. I was like, oh, okay, so this is what I need to do to get these ducks in a row. And this is, I need to make sure that everything is prepared for my family in the event. And I was really thinking like I had 60 days. And so I just was very pragmatic about it. And what I'm working on right now is trying to really be compassionate with myself and allowing myself to feel the feels of it and ride those waves. And when it,
those
when
are it such comes, being important reminders not to forget and really your self-care in the middle of all of this,
a safe space but for myself.
You bring up such a great point, Dawn, that we're given this diagnosis and maybe some of the statistics, but we don't know how long we're going to be able to keep working. We don't know how long we're going to be on a particular medication. And so planning for that short term and that long term, you know, those various experiences can be really challenging.
For me, every hour I don't work is money that I don't make. So it's a balance between what my budget requires and what my energy level is. And I have made that decision that I don't need to work 40 hours a week. And whatever that equates to for clients, it means I'm taking on less clients and I'm doing more different kinds of activities, more group courses, more video-based education rather than in-person workshops. So those are the kinds of things that I've been able to do, but I have the flexibility to do that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, I considered myself fairly knowledgeable. I've actually worked a lot with the ADA laws and making software accessible and understanding reasonable accommodations. But not only are there understanding there are federal laws, but there are state laws as well. And so that was something that was new to me, was trying to understand that my organization is based in DC. So they're following DC laws. I live in Virginia. And then there are federal laws. So there's all kinds of laws and different things. And sometimes you have to fill out double paperwork because of this. But yeah, so it is.
So we had Abigail a couple of questions from the people who are watching. And the first is from Natalia. Hi, Natalia.
Really helpful.
And she talks a little bit about Hispanic patients don't have the same education sometimes as people who are not solely Spanish speaking or who aren't immigrants, about how there are protections about breaks at work, especially if you work in an hourly job, or when you need to come back to work or take leave, that there's a significant lack of education here. And Natalia, you're absolutely right. It is not just limited to Hispanic patients, certainly, but certainly different cultures look at things differently. So one thing I just wanted to make sure that you knew is all of the resources at Triage Cancer are also available in Spanish. And so that is a great resource for people who may not know a whole lot about what they're entitled to, right? So there are lots of federal restrictions and it, you know, some of it depends on the size of the organization, but when you're an hourly worker, you are entitled. They are required to give you certain things like breaks at regular intervals. And so that's very important to know that, which is why discussions like this are so important to have and to talk to one another. So thank you for that, Natalia. Lisa, did you want to say something else about that?
I was just going to say, I have not, like, on a regular basis, but it's something I do think about and something I have thought about reaching out to my office about and how they would handle that, because I think that is important. And I'm not, you know, I, on the intermittent disability, you have to say like how much time you think you're going to need each month for treatment. And I always just say like 1 or 2 days. I could probably decrease, you know, based on that.
Thank you for that, Lisa. I appreciate you saying that.
I think it's something really important that I haven't reached out about.
Thank you all for sharing your stories, your personal experiences, and letting us know that we're not alone if we're living with a metastatic disease and we're continuing to work, that there are protections for us, there are resources out there, and I really appreciate you guys opening up and sharing the good, the bad, the ugly, and the realities of working with MBC. And thank you, everyone, for listening to our show. I would like to acknowledge that all of the information on our podcast are from personal experiences and are not a substitute for professional medical advice. You should always contact your medical care team. If you're looking for specific topics or would like to be a guest on our show, please feel free to reach out to me. My email is laura@survivingbreastcancer.org. Until next time, keep on thriving.